This episode was recorded for my UK column show. Please keep us independent by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
You have written a fairly controversial book. It's been removed from Amazon, and I like that. Whenever that sort of thing happens, it makes me realize that you're probably over the target.
That's the idea. I mean, actually, it's also been banned from another platform called Lulu.com, which is just a small book publisher. But I'm currently trying to kind of get it somewhere where I can know that it's going to be safe and it's not going to be taken down. And the interesting thing is that no one wants to tell me exactly why it was banned, but I have a very good idea why.
The name of your book is The Cult of the Chosen Ones.
So basically what this book does is it's 700 pages, almost 900 footnotes, so it's very comprehensively researched. But I've tried to trace the rising of this cult, and I picked up the trail in the Middle East, you know, a couple hundred years before AD. And I've shown how this cult kind of arose there. It either created or hijacked Judaism, depending upon your interpretation. I believe it kind of spread out into the other monotheistic Abrahamic religions too. But basically I trace it through how it kind of hijacks Judaism and then goes up through the Middle Ages. And it's the first few chapters are on this older era. But by the time we get to, say, chapter 4, quarter of the way through the book, we're into the 16th and 1700s, and then I'm talking about the rise of two fake Jewish messiahs, Sabbatai Zevi and Jacob Frank. And it's super important to understand these figures because they had a tremendous influence on what is basically a satanic cult that runs the world today. And you can really see, just going back a couple of hundred years, how these two men started entire movements, and then these movements influenced other families and dynasties that went on to become the leaders of the New World Order. And then once we get into the kind of 1800s, there's a lot more history then we can actually kind of prove and verify. You know, it's more recent in our past. And so I trace how private banking spread around the world, especially in Europe. We have the key revolutions like the American, French, and Russian revolutions. Then we get into things like when we get into the 20th century, of course, the two world wars and the rise of the Nazis, the founding of Israel, and then all the assassinations that have happened, especially JFK. There's a big chapter on that. And then false flag operations, all the false flags that have happened, including 9/11, the big one, all the way up to the Gaza genocide. And I try to connect the dots and show how it's really the same cult operating behind the scenes, hiding behind the cover of Judaism, that's responsible for all of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very important disclaimer there, because right off the bat, people are going to go, it's the Jews again, you're going after the Jews. But what you're actually doing is something similar to what David Icke, I think, has done, where he says, no, just hang on a second, there's something deeper than that.
For sure, yeah, it's not all the Jews. That's a really kind of intellectually lazy way to just, make sense of it. It's so much more than that. There's a key cult that's satanic ultimately, and they have manifested themselves through Judaism, and but they don't represent all Jews, not even close. And they are doing stuff in the name of Jewish people and Judaism that a lot of Jewish people would be totally horrified about if they actually knew what was going on. They would be totally up and screaming and saying, don't do this in my name. And some of them are doing that, to their credit. But a lot of them just don't understand, because they've been bamboozled, they've been programmed to think that these people that run Israel, the ultra-Zionists, represent them and are doing everything that, you know, in the best interest of Jews. And they're not. They're absolutely not. And that's a really key thing to discover. And so what I tried to do in the book is actually quote a lot of Jewish people who've realized this and have spoken out against this cult and said, you know what, you guys don't represent me. If this is what Judaism is, then I quit being a Jew. You know, some of them have even said that. And just there's been a lot of key Jewish thinkers who have exposed this cult and their propaganda. And I try to quote them as much as possible so that we can really get like a view from the inside.
To be fair, the majority of Zionists today are actually Christians.
that's another huge part of the story, because the Rothschilds, by the time they had risen to power in by around 1800, they were incredibly wealthy, and they'd set their sights on world domination. And they embarked on a very long plan, decades or centuries in the making, where they basically wanted to get a big chunk of America, a big chunk of the Christians on their side, because they knew they would need that kind of support, that the majority of the world, you know. So they basically... They engineered it so that they could publish their own version of the Bible, and they introduced, you know, all these weird things which are completely foreign to Christians outside of America. You know, I grew up in Australia, and I'd never heard of something like the tribulation or the rapture until I came to America, and I'm like, what is this? I'd never heard about that this was part of Christianity. Or and then it took me a long time to realize, you know, it was very prevalent among the evangelicals in the American South, and it's totally taken root there, this whole Christian Zionism thing, and how to be a good Christian you have to be blessing Israel and favoring Israel and all this stuff. And it turns out, well, they had co-opted a couple of men and gotten them to write different Bibles and seed all this stuff and make it seem like it was part of Christianity. And it's very clever what they did, because now, as you said, you have a big part of at least the American Christians, the American South, supporting Israel without even really knowing why.
Yeah, it's just like blind loyalty. It's very strange. I've asked a number of my Christian friends who stand with Israel, quote unquote, why? And they can't really give me a coherent answer.
Yeah, and I went deep into another aspect of this whole propaganda, which is something you'll often hear Netanyahu say. He likes to jump up there and say, well, you know, Israel is like a bastion against the barbarians. We're an outpost of Western civilizations, and we're upholding Judeo-Christian values. Also, there's always this term that's thrown around, Judeo-Christian values. But if you really look at that, if you really look into what that means, it's one of these oxymorons and this thing that doesn't make sense, because, you know, the Jewish faith is talking about how they are the chosen ones, and it's a very kind of supremacist, exclusivist ideology, and that doesn't go along with completely another religion. You know, it doesn't really make sense. Not to mention that if you look at the Old Testament God and the God of the Torah, the Jewish Bible, first of all, it's a male God, not a female, and he's a very vengeful, vindictive, totally murderous and genocidal character. Now, that also forms part of the Old Testament of Christianity, but Christianity also has the New Testament, and it has other values such as, you know, aspiring for unconditional love, loving your neighbor, humility, kindness, patience, meekness, these kind of things. At least they're in the mix in Christianity. But in Judaism, I don't see that. You don't find that. So how do we possibly reconcile this Judeo-Christian values thing when there's all these different values being thrown around, and we have like different divine figures? It doesn't stand up to close scrutiny. But they don't. It's like these political terms. They don't want people to think. They don't want people to examine or scrutinize it. They just want people to blindly think, oh yes, Jews and Christians have always been together, and it's one thing, and I should support Israel, and kind of shut off critical thinking.
Okay, so take me back to the start.
So basically, there seemed to be a sect within Judaism that arose somewhere a couple of hundred years BC, and they started telling everyone, well, we are the chosen people. Now, there's different theories about where this whole thing came from. Some people say, well, this was a Jewish way of trying to outwit the Romans, because the Romans were very powerful. They conquered a lot of the area, and no one could really beat them militarily at this point in time. And so some people say, well, also, the Jews...
Whoa, which area? You're talking about sort of the Mesopotamian region?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the height of the Roman Empire, at least, you know, a couple, you know, let's say take around the time 200 or 300 BC, they had conquered a lot of the area in the Mediterranean, the Middle East. They'd gone all the right way over to Palestine and Lebanon, and you know, they couldn't be defeated militarily at that point. It was going to be many more hundreds of years before they started to fall. So some people theorize, well, the Jews as a group then, they couldn't defeat the Romans militarily, but what they could do is they could invent a religion and start basically use this religion almost as a psychological operation. And if you can get your enemy or the people around you to kind of believe in your story, to believe in your ideology, that can be a very effective way that you can raise your own position and status. And especially if your story involves a God that favors you above anyone else, and you being the selected ones and the chosen people and all this, if you can get people to believe in that, that's a very big victory. And so this is what they did. Basically, they spread this thing out. And, you know, it's hard to say, because there are some researchers that talk about, some researchers like John Lamb Lash, for example, a Gnostic scholar, he talks about how it was a certain sect within Judaism called the Zadokim, and that translates as the righteous ones. But it's kind of almost a sarcastic thing, because they're not really very righteous at all. They're very arrogant. They're very conceited and supremacist. But they then exported this idea out to the world, and Christianity and Islam became spin-offs of this like monotheistic idea that there's one God and he favors those that believe in him and whatever. So there are slightly different interpretations of what happened. But what I also cover in my book is that the whole thing about the Jewish Bible, that appears to have been copied from Plato and other Greek writers. Because Plato and the Greek writers were the whole, you know, flower of civilization. That was happening around 500, 400 BC. So by the time we get to 200 BC, we're a couple of hundred years later, and there is an author I quote called Russell Gmurkin, who did a lot of study on this, and he found that there were Jewish writers at Alexandria at around 270 BC who basically copied Plato's laws, the whole idea of a constitution and then laws, and they basically Judaized it and made it a Jewish thing, and then the Jewish Bible came out of that, and they tried to pass it off as something original or something that Moses had gotten from God, or that it was divinely, you know, orchestrated and all of this. But actually, a lot of the stories have incredibly similar parallels to Greek stories, whether it's the Odyssey, like the epics, Aeneas and Odyssey and the heroes from there, or from other Greek writers. When you do a close analysis, you can see that it's almost identical. They've maybe changed a few names and a few minor details. Even the story of how Moses was born, like he was a baby in a river with papyrus, like that was lifted from a Greek story. So virtually everything in these Jewish stories was lifted from the Greeks. And so when I put all this together, I began to see, wait a minute. So there's been a certain group of people that have basically started to spin a whole story out of nothing, copying it from other sources. They've created a whole religion. Their religion tells them that they're the chosen ones and they're superior to anyone else. And then they're exporting this out to the world and trying to get other people to believe it. But what's important to understand is that there was a group of people at that time called the Gnostics. And there were certain Gnostic leaders who, when they heard this whole ideology, they spoke out against it. And they said, you know what, this is nonsense. God is not a man. God is like half man, half woman. God is genderless. And there are no chosen people that are favored among all others. And there is no judgment day where people are going to get punished if they don't, you know, submit to God's rules. And so they kind of went through step by step all the aspects of this theology, and they basically debunked it. Including, of course, this idea of salvation, that there is something wrong with you inherently and you have to be saved. And not only that you have to be saved, but you can't do it yourself. You're not worthy of that. You need a Messiah. So you have to look outside of yourself to someone, a Messiah, who's going to come and do the saving for you. And there's so many aspects to this whole ideology which are very disempowering. And you can find a lot of these elements in Christianity too. And so the Gnostics were you know, very vocal in speaking out against this, and they were murdered. They were brutally murdered. And so this ideology then spread up to the Middle Ages. And where I pick the trail up after that is with the rise of Sabbatai Zevi in the 1600s.
Okay, wait. So let me just make sure I'm following. So there was this group of people who effectively infiltrated the Jews, the ancient Jews, in the Roman Empire. Is that right?
That's one interpretation. I can't say I know for sure. That's one interpretation, is that they infiltrated and hijacked it. The other interpretation is that Judaism was created out of this, that they started something. Okay. It became a religion,
Okay, I follow. And so then where does then Jesus fit in? Does he fit in at all?
Well, some again, it depends which source you use and what you believe. There are some people such as Adam Green, nomorenews.com. He's of the opinion that Jesus, the Christianity was basically invented by the Jews because they'd already had their religion up and running for, you know, hundreds of years before Jesus came along, and they wanted a religion for the non-Jews, the Goyim, as they call them, the Gentiles. And so they basically invented Christianity, which is pretty similar. I mean, you know, it's in a lot of ways, it's very similar. It's using the Old Testament, which was the Jewish books. It's got a whole New Testament, but it's got very similar features that you have this God and you have to follow that. We've got the Ten Commandments, which is similar to the seven Noahide laws. And we've got the idea of a judgment day at the end of life. We've got the idea of a Messiah. You know, there's different Jewish messiahs and there's Jesus as the Messiah in the Christianity version. We've got the idea of salvation. You have to be saved. So a lot of elements are similar. You know, whether Jesus existed as a man or not is up for debate. Certainly there was a lot of stuff that was put onto him, projected onto him afterwards, whether it was the whole sun worship thing, astrotheology. Jordan Maxwell has done a lot of great work on that. Whether it was even other cults like magic mushroom cults were putting symbology and meaning into Jesus' life as well. So it's very difficult to try to work out whether Jesus existed as a man and what he really said at this point, because so much stuff has been overlaid afterwards.
And how does this connect then to the Roman Empire? Were they aware of any of this?
It's hard to say, but the Roman Empire at a certain point decided to join forces with Christianity, and then they really pushed out Christianity to the world. Now, if you're a Christian, or even for some non-Christians, you might think, well, this is a good thing, you know, like it's a religion that's helping people and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, there's the whole dark side to Christianity, some of which I've talked about, where there was the suppression of the Gnostics and people that didn't buy into this whole salvationist judgmental God, heaven and hell, and all these parts of the ideology. They didn't buy into that. So it was pushing that whole story out. And then it became, I mean, very militant. I mean, if you look up, look at all the crusades and all the things that were fought in the name of Christianity. And so this is completely divorced from, if Jesus was a real man, his message of unconditional love and meekness and humility, it's completely divorced from that, because suddenly we've got the cross and Christianity being used to justify conquering. And then when we go further up through the ages, when we get into the Middle Ages, we've got the whole Inquisition, and you're not allowed to think outside of standard doctrine, and the burning of witches. And so suddenly this thing that some people still say is a good force for good in the world has been used for some of the most evil and horrendous acts.
But you are referring more to the Catholic Church and the Vatican.
Yes, well, they were the main Christian sect for a long. They're the original Christian sect. So, yeah, yes, a lot of the evil was performed by them. But I mean, for me, I question the entire ideology of it, because
right.
I don't believe that we need to look outside ourselves to be saved. Not that we're not. I mean, of course, there's always the question of free will and human beings being able to be evil. Of course, I understand that. But I think humanity has got itself into a lot of problems when we start looking for heroes and saviors, be they religious or otherwise. And just, I mean, look at what happens in the whole political scene. It's just so easy for politicians to psychologically take advantage of this weakness in human psychology, or this desire to for a hero or for a savior outside of ourselves. And they pose as that, and then they're able to kind of get away with even more evil by posing as the savior.
What about Islam, though? I mean, that also kind of fell into the Abrahamic trio.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know as much about that as Christianity and Judaism, but I do mention in the book something I find interesting, because when Muhammad was kind of on his way up, you know, people were like, who is this guy? I mean, why is he talking about this stuff? But in the pre-Islamic times, in the Arabic world, in Arabia, there was a lot of polytheism or pantheism, right? People had shrines to different gods. They were praying to all these gods. And Muhammad's, one of his main messages was monotheism. There's only one God. There's only one God. Like, that's actually like a phrase that's repeated over and over. There's no God but Allah in Islam, right? So on the one hand, you could say, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. That's just, it's promoting monotheism, and it's not really good or bad. It's just their belief. And I can see that perspective, but Muhammad would go around and actually smash what he called pagan idols in all these temples, because he was so obsessed with this idea of there only being one God. And so what I need what I'd like to offer your audience right now, an interesting perspective on this, is talk a little bit about the Gnostics and their beliefs around the Archons. So this is fascinating, right? Because the Gnostics believe that this whole world was basically an inferior copy of a world that had previously existed, which is kind of a Platonic idea. It's not like the Gnostics and Plato were probably the only people who ever thought of this. But they believe that somehow this world had been hijacked or corrupted. The Gnostics had a whole theology around it that discussed these kind of divine beings out in some other part of the galaxy called the Pleroma, and they're doing their creation, and one of them called Sophia accidentally falls in love with her creation and falls from the Pleroma to lower spheres, denser spheres, and then in doing so, basically, it never happened before that one of these higher gods would do this, and she accidentally created these class of beings that the Gnostics call the Archons. And these beings are inorganic beings, meaning they don't have souls or consciousness like humans do. And so they're kind of in between dimensions. You can't really see them with ordinary consciousness, but if you get into certain states of perception or awareness, you can see them. And they're basically inferior to us because they don't have the divine spark and the will and the ability to create. But they do have the ability to hijack perception and manipulate, and they are incredibly good at that. So they basically can invade us psychically and telepathically. They can implant thoughts into our head. And so because they can do that, they can make us believe absurdities and nonsensical things and thus control us that way. And so the Gnostics had a whole story around it, much in much more detail than what I've just described. But the essence of it is that some researchers such as John Lamlash believe that one of the Archons crowned himself king, and the Gnostics called him the Demiurge or Yeldabaoth. And it is quite likely or quite possible, I think, that this chief Archon was the one that ended up talking to people like Melchizedek and the Jewish leaders, maybe Muhammad, maybe Christian leaders, and convince them that he is the God of the universe when he's actually just an Archon. And one of the clues that this may be the case is if you look at the Ten Commandments, one of the first commandments is a commandment to love God. You should love God with all your heart. You will have no other gods. You'll have no other idols, all that kind of thing. Now, I have to ask, that on the surface, it might seem natural, like it might seem okay, but if we examine it a little bit more closely, why would we be commanded to love a God that had created us? I mean, love is something that comes naturally if you don't have resentment and fear and jealousy and stuff blocking it. I mean, it's like the natural state of humanity.
I mean, my wife doesn't demand that I love her.
Right. So once you start introducing the kind of obligation and the command and the demand to love, something's already gone wrong, because then that's not really love. There's an element of force in it. And so
arrogance.
Yeah. What is this element of force and arrogance? And I would also suggest fear. I would also suggest there is some kind of insecurity, because a divine being that had created the entire universe wouldn't need love from one person out of 8 billion or whatever it is. I mean, it's not going to be necessary for that being, right? So why is there suddenly a demand placed on us that we have to love God? So, you know, I kind of feel like this is the archontic influence in the Ten Commandments and in the start of the root of these Abrahamic religions, and that quite possibly we're not actually dealing with a supreme being after all. We're dealing with an imposter, an archon, and there's this is how the religions have been hijacked. And if you look at these three Abrahamic religions, I mean, there are billions and billions of people or followers in the world who follow these religions. And this is their only kind of idea of spirituality. Like they believe to be good people or to be upstanding spiritual people, they have to follow this religion. That's their identity. And so it's really been, for me, it's been hijacked. Like the natural way that humans are spiritual beings and we express our spirituality has been put into these boxes with this dogma and rigid ideology.
But when you say hijacked, you are implying that there is an individual, a group, or a framework behind it.
Yeah, and ultimately, I believe if you trace the real source behind the world's evils, behind the New World Order conspiracy, I believe it does go off-planet and interdimensional, because I've studied satanic ritual and black magic and this kind of thing in depth, And I believe this is what's really going on. This is the basically the interface, the connection between the archons or whatever entities there are that are running things, and then the world's leaders, the royals, the presidents, the prime ministers that appear on the world stage and appear to be running the show.
That dovetails with the sort of Ikean reptilian narrative.
Yeah, I mean, I've studied the testimony of a lot of people that have been at these rituals, been in this whole satanic network, and they've survived. They've actually lived to tell the story. And some of them, I mean, their tales are fascinating. And I don't believe that they're making it up. Their level of detail, the fact that they're from different countries, they're talking about the same kind of things happening at these rituals. They're talking about the same people being present. Some of them have even been groomed, not just to be present at the rituals, but to one day lead them. They were groomed from a young age to be like the leaders of this network. And so my book before the current one, a book I published at the end of 2023 called The International Satanic Network Exposed, I list 15 different survivors of this network and what, you know, I go through sometimes very gruesome details of what they witnessed, what had to participate in these rituals. And I talk about, you know, what the point of it is. And I believe there really is very, very strong evidence that this whatever gods they're praying to, whatever force, whatever entities that are being invoked during these rituals is actually what's running things.
You said interplanetary. Just expand a bit.
So what some of these witnesses describe or participants describe in the satanic ritual is that they're basically using the power of ritual, which again is just neutral. Ritual is kind of like technology or information. It can be used for good or bad. It really depends on the intent of the person using it. So you can have white magic and you can have ritual used in a positive way to help someone grow in consciousness and awareness and become a better person, or you can have it used in a complete the opposite way. So what these Satanists are doing is that they're basically harnessing the power of ritual, where they have, you know, costumes and robes and music in a certain kind of tone and atmosphere, and they're getting themselves into some certain state, and then, you know, they're using things like abuse and torture and sacrifice and blood drinking and rape and cannibalism, and they're using it in that way, and what's happening is demonic possession. They're getting possessed by whatever it is that's on the other side of this. You could call them demons, you could call them archons, entities, some kind of force, some kind of creatures that aren't normally able to be perceived, but in certain states where you use ritual or maybe you use drugs or something to expand your perception, it is possible maybe to have more communication or to open up the interface and perceive these beings or whatever. But in this satanic ritual, there's possession, and the archons are implanting thoughts in the minds of the people that are turning themselves over to this.
So, okay, hold on. When you talk about satanic and demonic, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about forces that lack any empathy or love, or if they have some, it's like basically so low that you can't really even perceive it. It's basically forces that are totally into control. They're totally selfish. They want to do things for their own ends, and they want to control humans, they want to control the planet, they want to turn this place into some kind of farm. And then they are basically, you know, the ones that I believe are controlling the minds of the people at these satanic rituals. So that's what I mean. I mean, some people will say, well, it's, you know, demons don't really exist. They're a figment of our imagination and it's just human evil and you're trying to personify evil or put a name on evil. I can understand that viewpoint. But I don't think that really explains everything that's going on here, because there are a lot of shamanic cultures in the past, and I don't know how much of your audience have read the Castaneda books, but they're an incredible series of books about a group of shamans in Central America that lived not that long ago. They talk about similar entities. Now, they didn't call them archons because that's a Gnostic word, but what they're describing is the same thing. And we've had other descriptions of these creatures, even in pre-Islamic Arabia, they were called the jinn, And ultimately, we have the jinn in Islam, and we also have the word genie that came from that. So there's different religions and cultures and shamanic traditions that have described similar entities. So I believe, actually, that the evidence is pretty strong that there is something there that we could open ourselves up to it. Some force that's very evil that wants to control us, wants to control the world. And unfortunately, there are some people that have got into this, and they think they're getting power, they think they're getting some high from working with these beings, but they're absolutely getting used and manipulated. When you read these accounts from different cultures across the world, and you see, wait a minute, there were texts 500 years ago or 2000 years ago talking about the same thing, then it starts to, I mean, for me, it started to dawn on me, wait a minute, okay, this thing's been going on a very long time, thousands of years at least, and we have different names for it, but, you know, we have pictures of God sitting on chairs and someone coming up and handing the baby to Baal and Moloch. We have stuff from out of Babylon and Sumeria. We have David Icke's work where he was talking to Zulu shamans like Credo Mutwa about it. And we have stuff coming out of Central and South America. Okay, like, there's a lot of evidence behind all of this. I think the view that these entities exist, I think there's more evidence for that view rather than just that it's human psychology and it's humans trying to personify evil.
You heard of something called a tokolosh, which is basically, it's like a little demon and has a very big penis. But it's part of that tribal. Sure. Of that tribal caricature of the same evil force that you're referring to.
Yeah, and which part of Africa is a tokolosh from? Like, is there a certain country or tribe?
Yeah, southern Africa. Southern. I think it falls into Zulu culture.
Okay, all right. And then something just popped into my head as well is Wetiko. I forget which culture talked about Wetiko, but it might have been an African culture. But the idea of Wetiko is the mind virus, is that our thoughts are not really our own. And you can take people that are completely rational and seem to be sensible, and then they can do these crazy things or believe these crazy things. And there's a whole lot more to it. But when you look at your own thoughts sometimes, this is of course a big theme in Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism, Zen Buddhism. These thoughts that are in our head, they just seem to be repetitive and fear-based and anxiety-provoking. And it's like, where are they really coming from? Do they really belong to me? And I know that the shamans in the Castaneda series, like Don Juan, he was speaking to Carlos Castaneda, the author of the whole series, at one point, and he was saying, this is the topic of all topics for sorcerers or shamans. Our thoughts are not our own. Basically, we have like a foreign installation in our mind. And this explains why man can be a brilliant engineer and you have these brilliant feats of humanity. And then you have, you know, right next to that, adjacent to it, we have completely insane human behavior throughout history, whether it is self-destruction, suicide, war, jealousy, fighting over stupid and irrelevant things, and all the stuff that humans have done to each other. It helps explain why that is.
And part of what you're saying in your book is that a lot of this evil can be connected to that bloodline, that infiltration, quote unquote, from the BC era all the way up until today.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always been evil, and certainly you can take the story back further. You could go back to like 2000 BC or 4000 BC, and you can look at Sumeria, or you can go all the way back to 10,000 BC. Lots of authors have done studies on the catastrophes and the floods, and, you know, was Atlantis a real place? Did we fall from consciousness then? A fascinating topic, but yes, I don't get into that in this book. I try to pick it up later than that, a couple of hundred years BC. But where I focus most of the book is when we get to the 1600s up to the present era. Because then I can really, there's a lot of footnotes. We can really, I think, be more sure about this particular cult and how they've influenced the current state of affairs in today's world.
So what started happening around the 1600s?
Well, we had the rise of a man called Sabbatai Zevi, and he was born in Turkey. It was then the Ottoman Empire. And he, at a certain point, decided that he was going to proclaim himself to be the Messiah. And he chose deliberately the year of 1666. Now, in the Jewish religion, there's basically three holy books. There's the Torah, the Talmud, and the Kabbalah, or the Kabbalah. And the Kabbalah is concerned with codes and the way that numbers and words work together and hidden connections with all of this. There's another word, gematria, for all of this stuff. And so they studied this really closely and they were very into it. I should really note that all three of these books, these Jewish holy books, all contain the idea of Jewish supremacy within them, that if you're a Jew, you're somehow part of the selected few and the chosen ones, and you're inherently superior to other people. So right there and then we have a big problem, because if we have any kind of ideology or religion that teaches that, it's going to create problems, because its followers are then going to go out and start feeling like they have the license to get all the privileges and to treat other people worse than them. So anyway, Sabbatai Zevi, by today's standards, some people would believe that he could be classified as a manic depressive, or even bipolar, or that he was psychotic. He would go away and do bizarre things, fast for weeks on end, and have visions and dreams. But one of his visions was that there would be a Jewish holy land and country, basically, in Palestine. So right there and then, we can trace the whole current Zionist movement back to this guy. But he declared himself to be the Messiah deliberately in the year 1666. So he had the three sixes there. And he had a PR man, like a wingman, his right-hand man, called Nathan of Gaza, who used to go around with him and explain Sabbatai Zevi's work. And he drew a massive following. It is said that he had half the world's Jews as his followers in that time, which was said to be around 1 million Jews. Eventually, he ran into trouble with the local political leaders of the era. The Sultan of the Ottoman Empire eventually said to him, okay, like, enough. You either, here's a turban, so you either choose a turban or death, meaning you either convert to Islam or you die. So he converted to Islam, and he lost a lot of his supporters who said, oh, this guy's a charlatan, he's fake. But he managed to retain a lot of supporters, because partly due to the skill of his PR man, Nathan, who basically spun it and said, well, this is prophesized, this is written, you know, it's said in our holy books that the Messiah would come and that he would deliberately take on the guise of other religions or other things, and this is all part of it. And so some people believe that, and they still kept following him. And so what he did, though, was on the outside he converted to Islam, but on the inside he remained Jewish, and they still followed all their Kabbalistic practices, some of which were things like group orgies. And, you know, it's hard to say exactly how much of the satanic influence was there. I don't know if he was raping kids or encouraging rape, but there was certainly a lot of deliberate inversion of Jewish norms and customs. So on days where they would normally be fasting on the Jewish calendar, they would feast. So they would turn everything round. And their excuse was, well, it's he's the Messiah and we're in Messianic times. And so everything gets inverted. And so to me, that's a real clue there, because for those of you that might know about this who have studied Satanism, one of the key tenets or ways you can distinguish Satanism is that it's about inversion. Black is white, up is down, pleasure is pain. And so right there, we have the satanic inversion you can see in Sabbatai Zevi. But basically, he went on, he soon died after that, but his followers kept thriving. And interestingly enough, in this whole same area, the Ottoman Empire, Turkey, we had the rise of something called the Dönme Jews. And Dönme is a Turkish word meaning to turn. And that's because of the Sabbatai Zevi turning away from Judaism to Islam. But these Dönme Jews are also called crypto Jews. And so we had this whole rising up of this new class of Jews that were one thing on the outside and then something else on the inside. And so it became like a trademark for them to basically practice this deception. And so it's a very interesting story, but it doesn't end there, because after Zevi died, about 50 years later, another guy came along called Jacob Frank. And he was born in Poland, but in his earlier years, he visited the Turkish, the area of Turkey where Zevi died, and he you know started learning about his followers and his ways, and then he proclaimed that he was the Messiah as well, and not only that, he proclaimed that he was the incarnation of Sabbatai Zevi. And so he got a lot of followers, and basically kind of took over the Sabbatean movement that then became the Sabbatean Frankist movement, named after the last names of both these guys. Now, the thing about Jacob Frank is he was an absolute psychopath. We know this. There's more documentation on him because he was born more recently. But he used to say that the only way to salvation was through transgression, through sin. There was no other way. Like we couldn't possibly do everything right and be holy. So we're going to go to the opposite extreme, and we're going to do every single thing that's evil as possible, because this is going to hasten the arrival of the Messiah and the Messianic era and the redemption of the world. Now, it's complete nonsense. I mean, it doesn't make any logical sense. But this is what they believed, not just him, but all his followers. And so he encouraged his followers to basically throw away every moral scruple and do the worst things possible. And so he would go out of his way to do evil things, including raping his own daughter and then pimping his daughter out to get more followers for his sect. And so this, you know, and he was also into things like blood drinking, satanic ritual, torture, sacrifice, rape. And so his movement started gaining a lot of followers. And of course, as you can imagine, he started getting kicked out of place after place after place wherever he went. You know, he made his way back up to Poland. He was eventually thrown in jail for quite a time. But towards the end of his life, he made his way to Germany, to Frankfurt. And it just so happened that Frankfurt was the hometown of the Rothschilds. They were originally called the Bauers, but they had a red shield above their door, and Rothschild in German is red shield. They took the name Rothschild, and by that point, when Meyer Amschel Rothschild, who was the head of the dynasty, and Jacob Frank crossed paths, Amschel had already started to get his kind of banking business going, and that this scam of paper money and fractional reserve banking was starting to basically make it very profitable. And then, you know, as the story goes, he sent his five sons out to other major capitals in Europe and started setting up a whole banking system in Europe. And quickly, it didn't take that long, just a generation or two, before he became the wealthiest person in Europe and the world through this. And so Rothschild had the funding, and then Jacob Frank introduced the Satanism, and they crossed paths and formed an unholy alliance. And so that's where we get the root of this, the current New World Order that we're hopefully all trying to stop and push back against. The roots of it are with these two Jewish messiahs, and then the second one of them crossing paths with the head of the Rothschild family. What also happened around that time was Rothschild, by the time he had become very wealthy, he set his sights on like not just European domination, but world domination. And so he set up a plan. And part of his plan was to basically create a secret society, or many secret societies, and then using this crypto-Jew, Derme-Jew infiltration trick, was to get inside other established organizations and have his agents rise to the top and basically infiltrate and hijack these organizations. And so the original Illuminati was created with Adam Weishaupt in the year 1776, May 1st, the same year that the USA was born. And so Weishaupt was Jesuit trained, and the Jesuits, if you trace those back, they were started by a guy called Ignatius Loyola, who was also a crypto Jew. And so they already had this same kind of philosophy of the infiltration aspect. And so the Illuminati started up, and you can actually read in Weishaupt's diaries how he targeted the Freemasons as being the perfect brotherhood or secret society to infiltrate, because they were already very well established and they actually had a good reputation at that point in time. And so the Illuminati started going into Freemasonry, entering the lodges, rising up the ranks. And my research showed that it was only in around 10 years or so afterwards that they had basically gotten to the top of Masonry. And so then they were able to direct what happened in Masonry. So this is maybe like the late 1780s, 1790, this time period. And so they had control of Masonry. They had control of the Jesuits who were infiltrating the Vatican. And they started basically just spreading out and infiltrating governments. They had central banks that were owned by the Rothschilds and other people that were in on this. And so by the time we got to 1800, this plot was already pretty far advanced. And Rothschild left a will where he laid out what he wanted. He wanted intermarrying between his family. He wanted, you know, first cousins to marry each other. He wanted, he basically laid out the plan for the world domination using these kind of methods. And basically what happened, I would say, after that was the Rothschild started funding the French Revolution through the Jacobins. That happened around the 1790s. By the time we got to 1810, 1815, we'd had Napoleon, we'd had all sorts of war throughout Europe, and a lot of the European countries were war ravished and they were tired of war. And so then he launched his first, I would say the first real attempt at a world government, which was called the Concert of Nations. And this was around maybe 1815 in Vienna. But there were certain European leaders that saw through it. They could tell that it was the Rothschilds behind it. They'd already gained a reputation by that point for being ruthless and evil and cunning. And it was especially the Russian Tsar, the Russian royal family, that were like, wait a minute, this guy doesn't want to have a concert of nations because he cares about world peace. He wants to unite all these European nations under one government and then get control of that government. That's his plan. And so he saw through it and he spoke out against it. And ultimately, even though the Rothschilds had kind of certain leaders under their, you know, in their pocket, under their thumb at that point, they didn't quite have enough power to pull it off. But it is said that they didn't forget what happened and that they got their revenge on Russia later. So then while this was going on, basically the European countries, a lot of them already had Rothschild fully owned, partially owned central banks. And so then they were trying to get a foothold in the New World, in the United States. And so what's fascinating is to look at American history throughout this period, because there were a series of central banks in America that were foreign owned. Undoubtedly, they were owned by the Rothschilds and other rich families, but they always had charters. They had like a 20-year charter that didn't get renewed. And so then there had to be another one for 20 years. And so we reach kind of the period of around the 1820s when Andrew Jackson came to prominence, and he was a very popular fighter. I think he might have been a general, but he was definitely a military man who'd scored famous victories. And for whatever reason, even though he had a lot of parts of his character that weren't to be liked, I mean, he was very racist. He was a very popular guy, and he launched an entire campaign for the presidency that was basically just based around no central bank. And he seemed to grasp the issue very keenly, and so did the American public, especially compared to today. They understood that if there was going to be a foreign private bank, it's pretty soon that it would get control of the economy and it would like destroy the currency and everyone would be enslaved to it. And so Jackson was elected president on this basis. And so he basically got into power, even though the Rothschilds had other agents and tried to stop him, they couldn't. And then he vetoed the bank. The charter came up while he was president. Congress voted for it, he vetoed it, as was his right as the president. And so this caused massive consternation. The Rothschilds were furious. And so then we have the first attempted assassination of an American president, the attempt on Andrew Jackson, which failed, only because the guy that shot tried to, apparently, as the story goes, he tried to shoot him twice, and both times the gun misfired. I mean,
what are the odds?
I know, what are the odds? Actually, Andrew Jackson at this point was a very tall fellow. He had a cane, and apparently he got his cane and just like beat this guy almost to death on the steps of some famous building. But anyway, what's interesting around this whole time period is just the consciousness, because even the early colonists had a lot of consciousness and awareness around the control of currency and who needed to control that and how important that was for a free society. And Benjamin Franklin is quoted as saying that the real reason for the revolution in the 1770s was actually so the colonists could have their own money and not have to use English pounds. And so I think we've really lost this part of our history, and the general average consciousness of society has been dropped down deliberately or being taken down deliberately, especially when it revolves this idea of money and who should issue money and what money should be, paper or gold or whatever. Anyway, Andrew Jackson eventually, you know, faded into obscurity after he'd done this thing, and the Rothschilds kept kind of fighting more. And then we had Abraham Lincoln, who came along, and he was basically in a very difficult position because the Rothschilds were funding various foreign armies. There were the British in Canada, the French and the Spanish were in Mexico. There was even a Belgian and Austrian army. So there were five potential foreign armies that could have invaded on the side of the South, the Confederacy against the Union. And Abraham Lincoln was saved because Russia sent its warships over to New York and San Francisco and said, if any foreign army attacks the North and attacks Lincoln, Russia would consider that an attack on herself and would defend and would shoot. And so it is said that Lincoln actually met with the Rothschilds, and they were basically trying to get him to sign onto a new central bank, and they were extorting him. You know, they wanted huge interest rates to be able to print the currency. They wanted a monopoly on the currency, all of this. And so Lincoln basically was polite to them, but then after they left, he was like, I'm never going to let these guys get a hold of this, you know, no way. And so this is really what the whole U.S. Civil War was about. It wasn't really about slavery. That was just like something almost extra that was thrown on to maybe confuse people, or maybe to try to a plot to get the South away from the North. But basically, you know, as we all know, Lincoln met his fate, and he was assassinated successfully. But he was assassinated by John Wilkes Booth, who was Jewish. His father was a Talmud scholar, and there is connections, incredibly strong connections between Booth and Judah Benjamin, who was the second or third highest guy in the Confederacy in the South, who was a Rothschild agent who escaped back to England. And so already we have the, even in the 1800s, we have revolutions, we have assassinations attempted and successful ones organized by the Rothschilds, which are heading up this satanic cult. And this is it. We aren't even into the 1900s yet, but already their grip can be felt very heavily upon the world.
Wasn't Rothschild involved with the creation of Israel?
Absolutely. And so what was going on was, towards the end of the 1800s, this is when they were launching their whole decades-long plan, or maybe even centuries-long plan, of changing the Bible. They had a guy called John Darby who was preaching the tribulation dispensations and all of this stuff. And then they had a guy called Cyrus Scofield, who was actually like a crook. He wrote his own Scofield Bible. He was influenced by Darby, and he inserted these things about blessing Israel and putting in chapters into the Bible that didn't exist, not chapters, sorry, verses, sentences that were basically trying to justify the existence of an actual state called Israel, not like a figurative place, but an actual political nation state. And he had footnotes and all of this. And so by the time that Scofield was writing his Bible, the 1880s, 1890s, the Rothschilds owned Oxford Press. So they were able to print massive amounts of this Bible and then distribute them. And they started to take root in the American South, the evangelical community. And so then this whole ideology got seeded in a big part of America. And so they were planting the seeds for the creation of Israel, because by then they had got to the point where they had central banks in a lot of countries, but they wanted their own country. And so they hatched this plot very early on to basically take part of Palestine. Now, it's fascinating to kind of research and ask the question, why Palestine? I mean, they could have set up a country in a lot of parts of the world, but there's been some obsession that can be traced back to Sabbatai Zevi and even before him, of this wanting Jerusalem and wanting Palestine and wanting to kind of control the earth there. Now, David Icke is of the opinion that it's because there's certain ley lines that intersect through Jerusalem, that they want control of that, that it's a real power center. And I mean, that could be. I'm open to that interpretation, but to me, it's still a bit of an open question of like, why are they that obsessed with Jerusalem? And we saw the obsession with Jerusalem too throughout the Middle Ages, with the Templars, with all these crusades and wars over this apparently holy city. So there's been a big obsession over this piece of land for a long time. But basically, the Rothschilds set it up so that they were putting the idea in Jewish people's minds and Christians that Israel had already had existed as its own country, and it should exist, and it should control Palestine and Jerusalem. And they were putting this in their Bible, trying to make it, give it more authority and make it sound more esteemed because it was in the Bible. That's a big part of this mind trick. And so they were planting the seed for all this. So by the time we got to 1900, they had agents in a lot of the cabinets in the powerful countries such as England and France. And they were then, that what they did next was that they started to organize secret alliances. And this, another part of the story comes in here, is that basically Germany was starting to become a strong nation. It had only become a federation in 1871, but because of its, it had naturally has had a lot of people that are brilliant engineers and technicians and scientists. And so it was starting to manufacture a lot of things. It was starting to build a navy. And suddenly Britain was getting worried, because up until then, Britain had been the sole superpower and a lot of its power had been based on its navy. And Germany was starting to manufacture goods just as good as the British, in fact, even better. And it was starting to build its own navy. And so So British, the Britons, well, the people at the top of Britain, which were basically part of the satanic cult, they were definitely connected to the Rothschilds. They were looking over with apprehension at Germany, and they were like, all right, we have to do something about this, because if we don't really stop Germany, pretty soon they're going to become number one. And not only that, they could easily form a natural alliance with Russia. And then we're going to have this massive country with this unlimited resources and a massive land army that no one, Napoleon can't beat. No one can seem to beat the Russian land army. All these resources combined with the German technology and brilliance and science, and that's going to be an unstoppable combination. Basically, no other combination is going to be able to beat the German-Russian alliance if it ever became, it came into being. And so they formed a whole foreign policy around preventing this alliance. And their strategy was to basically isolate Germany, because they knew they couldn't really defeat Russia just being so big, but they could defeat Germany. And so basically they decided that they would ally with France, even though they had a traditionally, you know, bitter rivalry with France, and same with Russia, to form a British-French-Russian alliance. And that way they would isolate Germany politically as well as geographically, and they would be able to beat them. And so all these things, these machinations were being set up. 1905, 1907, this whole period, like quite a few years before World War I broke out. And so it was interesting because James Corbett did research on this in his documentary. I think it's called something about World War I. But basically, not even the British upper levels, not even all the members of the British Parliament or whatever knew about this. It was only just a very few people at the top knew about these secret alliances until it became too late. And this is really a good key to how the world is controlled, because a lot of people are just so surprised. They're like, how can just a few hundred people or whatever, just a few thousand people at the top control 8 billion people? Well, this is how it's done. If you get control at the top levels of a certain organization, whether it's a government, whether it's a secret society like Freemasonry, then you can make these secret plans and you can control everyone below it, because a lot of these organizations are very hierarchical. The people at the very top, in the top degrees of Freemasonry or in the top levels of government, they don't share all these details with the people below them. They're just instructed to follow orders or whatever. And if people start asking questions, they can get fired. And so, you know, they arranged all this in secret, and they had the pieces in place so that when the shot rang out in Sarajevo and World War I was triggered, all these alliances suddenly got triggered. Well, you know, if you declare a war on this country, I declare war on you. Well, if you declare war on me, I declare war on you, and so on. And suddenly there were six countries or so, or more than that, that were all at war with each other in 1914. And then the Rothschilds had gotten the war that they wanted. And so what happened was, when we got about halfway through that war, World War One, in 1916, Germany had the upper hand. They had managed to subdue France and mostly subdue Britain. And so they made actually quite a magnanimous offer. And they said, look, we'll agree to end the war. Let's just go back to the way things were before the start of the war. That's our offer. And Britain was probably on the verge of taking it, to be honest, because they were worse off. But then the Rothschilds had their agents in power, and so they said to the British Prime Minister and the leaders at the time, don't take that offer. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to get the US, we're going to get America in on your side, and that's going to swing the favor in your, it's going to swing the balance in your favor. America will crush it. They've got a strong industrial base. They'll win the war for you. And Britain was like, well, how are you going to do that? And they're like, don't worry about how we're going to do that. But here's what we need in exchange for this. We need you to promise that you will give part of Palestine to make it into a Jewish state. And at that time, Palestine had been controlled by different empires. It was part of the Ottoman Empire during the times of Sabbatai Zevi. But in that period, 1916, it was controlled by the British. It was called Mandatory Palestine. And so the British agreed to this. And so this is where we get this famous 1917 Balfour Declaration. Alfred Balfour was part of the British cabinet. And so he wrote a letter to none other than Lord Walter Rothschild saying that they would promise Palestine to the Jews and for the creation of a Jewish state. So the Rothschilds got what they wanted. They then engineered a false flag operation, the Lusitania, and they managed to get it so that the Germans would fire on it because it was actually carrying munitions, even though it was a passenger ship. So the Germans, you know, as far as they were concerned, it was a legitimate target. And so they whipped up all this outrage. It was totally pre-planned. They sacrificed lives. It's the same template that they've always done throughout history. There's been so many examples of it, but this is one of the earlier ones. Then there was outrage, and then Woodrow Wilson was goaded into like declaring war on Germany, even though he said he wouldn't do that. And the America entered on the side of Britain and France, and pretty soon. You know, they came in at the end, but they were able to swing it in a decisive way for the Allies, and Germany lost the war. And so then we had a situation where the Rothschilds were on their way to creating their state of Israel, but they still needed a little bit more than that. And then immediately after that First World War ended, they were already hatching their plans for a Second World War.
World War II, Makia, is one of the great defining moments of modern human history, isn't it?
I mean, it's yeah, that's a good way to describe it. It's an incredible event. I mean, something like 55 million people dying. I mean, the amount of trauma and
savagery. Well, I mean, the state of Israel.
Israel, I mean, everything that came out of that war, it is absolutely a defining moment in the history of humanity. Huge. I mean, never before had there been a war like that. It dwarfed World War I, dwarfed everything else. I mean, all the people that died, all the technology that was used, all the countries that were affected. I mean, yeah.
Cold War. It's horrific. Yeah, and the Cold War.
Yeah. And to think that this was all planned, because see, what happened at the end of World War I was we have some interesting people that arose in the aftermath of that that went on to become very influential people. And what I'm talking about now are the Dulles brothers, Alan Dulles, John Foster Dulles, because Alan Dulles would later become the CIA director. And he was a chief mastermind of the Kennedy assassination, which I hope we can talk about if we have time in this interview. His brother, John Foster Dulles, was the Secretary of State during that same period, the 1950s. And so they would work together. And they were very evil. They were very connected to this cult. I mean, they weren't actual Zionists, but they were still connected to this cult. And they were carrying out, you know, this evil agenda. But they were lawyers at the Sullivan and Cromwell firm back then, and they were the lawyers that were drafting the Treaty of Versailles in 1918, which was hugely punitive to Germany, and it was deliberately so. They deliberately set it up like that so that Germany took all the brunt for the loss of World War I, even though it was fighting alongside the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Turks, other empires that took part in it and lost. I mean, it wasn't like it was just Germany. But the idea was to punish Germany so severely that it would create an equal and opposite reaction, just kind of like Newtonian physics. If you push the pendulum one way, it's going to swing the other way. So they made it so hard for Germany that it created fertile ground for the rise of an extreme right-wing fascist totalitarian movement in the which we saw in the Nazis and Hitler. And so basically we had Germany was down and out. I mean, they had hyperinflation during the Weimar Republic in 1923. There's these famous descriptions of people having to push wheelbarrows of notes just to buy a loaf of bread. Prostitution was rife. Germany was on the brink of collapse. It couldn't pay its war debts. And so by the terms of this Treaty of Versailles, nations like France were actually allowed to reinvade it, to go and take its resources because it couldn't pay. And so basically they offered these two five-year plans called the Dawes Plan and the Young Plan. So it's kind of funny because people seem to think, well, communism and fascism are completely different things. Well, actually, no, they're not. They all spring from this same source. This same Rothschild-led satanic cult was planning all this stuff out. And just so later on, you have the five-year plans in communist Russia and communist China. There were two five-year plans in fascist Germany in the 1920s. And so they were putting these plans into place. And of course, the corporations attached to the people that are part of this cult were buying up cheap German companies and real estate for pennies on the dollar, getting themselves situated. They introduced a new currency into Germany, and then they made that strong because at a certain point around 1924, they were like, okay, it's time to put our plan into motion now. What we're going to do is we're going to build Germany up. It's going to take us about 10 years. We're going to make Germany super strong. We're going to get rid of its debt. We're going to remilitarize. We're going to make it strong so it's a worthy opponent for the next world war. And so even though there were all these terms that Germany couldn't remilitarize and it couldn't do this or that, at the start, all these things were enforced, but gradually they stopped enforcing them and deliberately. And so they let Hitler, you know, rise up after he was in jail and that unsuccessful putsch or coup. They funded the Nazis. Hitler was funded into power. And this is a point I really want to make clear, because it just seems for so long there's been this thing in the alternative media about how Hitler was a good guy and Hitler was fighting the Jews and Hitler was fighting the New World Order. And I mean, I understand, where people get that interpretation and that impression, but it's simply not the truth. It's not borne out by the evidence. And the evidence is that Hitler was absolutely funded by the Rothschilds, by the Rockefellers, by these same bankers. They spotted him early on in the 20s. They saw that he was like a perfect demagogue and that he would basically be the ideal man to lead a new party that they were going to create, became the Nazis. And the thing about Hitler was that he actually loved the British. He was an Anglophile. He hated the French. He hated Jews. And so he was their perfect man because they never wanted Germany to really attack Britain. They wanted Germany to take out France. And the big thing was going to be for Germany to fight Russia, because that was really what World War II was about. It was really the Germans and the Russians that were doing the bulk of the fighting. And if we come back to what I was talking about a little earlier in this interview, this British scheme of separating Germany and Russia was still a big factor in all of this, all of these plans. So they were like, yeah, we're going to deliberately install a revolution in Russia that's going to have this communist, godless, atheistic kind of regime running it. And we're going to set that against a different ideology in Germany so that they're antagonistic to each other, so they're natural enemies, so that they will end up fighting each other. I mean, this stuff is really devilish. It's really evil, but this is what they did. They funded Hitler into power. There are books that I quote in my book, The Cult of the Chosen Ones, that talk about the bankers that met with him early on and gave him money. He had American handlers. There was one guy called Putzi. Putzi was his nickname. Humph Stengel was his last name. He actually played piano in the White House. He was very close to Roosevelt. He went to Harvard. He was basically Hitler's handler, and he became very close to Hitler. Hitler became the godfather of Putzi's sons. And he basically introduced Hitler into the high society so that he could end up rubbing shoulders with rich Germans, the German elite, the German industrialists, who he needed support from for the Nazis to actually become a viable party. Because at the start, they were just nobodies. They were like a southern German Bavarian little party that no one really cared about. They would never have gotten as big as they did unless it were for the funding. But of course, Hitler never talked about that. He never disclosed that he was getting funding from all these international bankers. He didn't even really want to know about it, who they were. He just wanted the money and not to ask too many questions. But basically, he was funded in a position. And by the time it got to 1930, the Nazis were more of a political force, but it took them a while to eventually get over the line. And I mean, the highest amount of votes they ever got was just in the mid-30s. You know, they were never, it's not like they ever got 50% or something of the vote. But 30%, 33% was enough to get Hitler into office to become the chancellor. And then what did they do once he became chancellor in 33? Well, they quickly launched another false flag operation, the burning of the Reichstag. And researchers like Anthony Sutton covered this in his books about how it was a false flag operation. And basically, they then passed the Enabling Act quickly after that, which consolidated and centralized power. And Hitler went after the role, the office of the presidency, and merged the presidency and the chancellor into one position. So then he started to become, you know, basically like a dictator pretty early on. And that's how it got rolling. And then they spent another 6 years funding the Germans, getting the military up until World War II actually broke out in 1939. So by the time we get to JFK, World War II is finished. We're in a completely different era of the Cold War, and we have this big battle between the US and Russia. But JFK, one of his many things was that he was determined to stop nuclear proliferation. And so when he found out that the Zionists had acquired nuclear weapons or nuclear program through France, he was on a mission to get every country to sign the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And the Zionists were holding out. They weren't going to sign it. And so Kennedy was putting more and more pressure on them. And in that day, the US was giving some aid to Israel, but nothing like today. And so basically it got to the point where he was exchanging telegrams. And this is public record. You can read it for yourself. Exchanging telegrams, letters with Ben-Gurion, the first Israeli prime minister. And he said to Ben-Gurion, look, if you don't let American inspectors in and let us confirm that you don't have a nuclear program, then it's going to jeopardize Israel's aid. So at that point, Ben-Gurion resigned because he was basically trying to buy time. He had no intention of giving up the nuclear program. And so it bought a little bit more time for them. And then basically a new Israeli prime minister came in and he said, oh yeah, we can set up an inspection maybe in 6 months, you know. But meanwhile, what appears to have happened is that the Mossad, who had been created as the premier Israeli spy agency, they were already getting pretty good at assassination. And so they had a very strong ally in the CIA, who was the number three man, James Jesus Angleton, who was he was apparently the biggest Zionist in Washington, according to one of the Mossad leaders. And so Angleton and the Mossad were constantly exchanging information, and Angleton was constantly visiting Israel. He even went and visited Ben-Gurion in his home, in his private home, after he had resigned as prime minister. So they were clearly hatching a lot of plans to kill Kennedy and to carry out, you know, one of their most massive operations ever at that time on foreign soil. And so I don't really have time to go into all the details here, but there are Zionist fingerprints all over the death of JFK. It's not the only reason he was killed, but I'd say it's one of the two main reasons alongside the extraterrestrial issue. But Israel had a huge, huge hand in it. And then after that, they completely controlled Lyndon Johnson. He did whatever he wanted. He did whatever Israel wanted. And that's when we had the Gulf of Tonkin incident, more wars. We had the USS Liberty sunk in 1967, and Johnson completely covered that up. I mean, that was just a blatant Israeli attack on an American ship. And Israel started basically getting a really strong grip over American foreign policy, over American politicians. And it can be traced back to this key era of Kennedy in the 1960s, where they took him out and they started to gain control.
Okay, Makia, how can my audience follow your work?
So best place is on my website, thefreedomarticles.com. I'm also on Rumble, BitChute, Odyssey. And if you go to thefreedomarticles.com, you can see where to buy my books. I have 5 books. The most recent is called The Cult of the Chosen Ones.
Absolutely fascinating stuff. Makia Freeman, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks for having me on.